So we're going to finish out our weekend with a great topic, AML, acute myeloid leukemia. We have a great faculty as well here, and we're going to focus really here on targeted therapy, except for the beginning, because I have to ask the faculty about something that's a non-targeted issue. So first, let me introduce everybody. We have Dr. Courtney DiNardo from the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, and Dr. Harry Erber from the Duke University School of Medicine in Durham. And back with us as a co-moderator, Dr. Gus Fonseca from the Florida Cancer Specialist Research Institute in Lecanto, Florida. Before we get into FLT3 and IDH, we've been having sort of this running chat about paper of the year. And even though I know this is about targeted therapy, when I saw this paper presented, I was like, I got to ask Dr. DiNardo what she thinks about this paradigm study. And also, Harry, I'm very curious what your thoughts are about it. Of course, we've been talking about HMA venetoclax for a long time, or actually seems like a long time, but maybe it's actually sort of reason in a way. And when we talk about targeted therapy, you're going to see all these trials combining with HMA venetoclax.
Yep.
But Courtney, can you just summarize what paradigm looked at, your colleague presented, Dr. Fathi, what it saw, and what do you think it means?
So I think AML, we've always had our curative standard intensive chemotherapy, 7 and 3 or something similar. And in the population that are inappropriate for a curative therapy, right? That's where HMA-Ven was evaluated. But the responses with HMA-Ven are so good. The question was, why do we need to have a patient be unfit in order to receive HMA-Ven? Should there be younger patients who are fit for intensive chemo that HMA-Ven might work well for also? So the paradigm study was a plenary at ASH, the annual hematology meeting this past year, doing just that. It was a randomized study looking at HMA-Ven versus intensive chemotherapy for patients who were medically fit for intensive chemotherapy.
But they also were not everybody. These were high-risk.
It was not everyone. And that is, I think, the key kind of take-home is that eligibility was not the patients that we know are cured with intensive chemotherapy, or at least have high likelihood. So the favorable risk patients with core-binding factor leukemias, the NPM1 mutated patients who were younger, the FLT3 mutated patients, those patients we know do better with intensive chemotherapy, so they were not eligible for this randomization.
So, Harry, how did this affect you and the way you practice?
No, it hasn't changed the way I practice at all. As Courtney said, we have to focus on the goal of therapy in AML, and we have a subset of patients who can potentially be cured with intensive chemotherapy, and we have to identify those patients at the time of diagnosis and put them on the right track. And we'll talk a little bit about NPM1 and some of the advances we're making there. In the patients who are have adverse risk features, spliceosome mutations, P53, chromatin modifiers, complex karyotypes, we know that chemotherapy is not going to cure them. We know that the only curative option is allogeneic transplant. And we have known that HMA-Ven, without a comparator trial for a long time, was apparently less toxic than 7 and 3. And so what's wrong with giving patients HMA-Ven in order to get them to a transplant, which is the only curative option? At the end of the day, the paradigm study didn't change anything. Unfortunately, the outcome for these patients, which were mostly, 75% were adverse risk by ELN 2022, the overall survival was still poor. And so we have a lot of work to do.
But presumably the toxicity treatment was less. Mm-hmm.
The toxicity was clearly less. And so we finally have a randomized phase 2 study that really showed that number of days and number of patients going to the ICU, quality of life, number of days in the hospital, and death. All of those were superior outcomes for HMA-Ven than for intensive chemo.
Courtney?
I think what it tells us, so we haven't seen, there's not a peer-reviewed manuscript yet, right? We only have the plenary abstract. I think what it does is it highlights what I think many of us No, which is that there are patients who are adverse risk by our classification systems, right, who don't do well with intensive chemotherapy. And so using AzaVen in patients with complex cytogenetics or, you know, certain splicing factor mutations, you actually have a higher chance of obtaining a remission. You have a better likelihood of transitioning that patient to a transplant without the toxicity of intensive chemotherapy than using intensive chemo. So it just gives you the ability to be smart about the treatment that you're using in the frontline setting, and it's no longer just age or just comorbidity. But I think we're going to need to see the data. We're going to need to see those different kind of groupings, in terms of kind of the subgroups and the cohorts in the final publication.
So, Gus, any questions? And also, I'm curious, I remember the first time I present, we did talk about AzaVen or HMA-Ven at a CME meeting was at the Florida with the Florida Cancer. I don't remember how many years ago it was, but I remember the looks on people's faces when we started talking about HMA venetoclax. They were like, what? Yes. And I was like, no, it's okay. And I'm kind of curious right now, is this something that you think people are very comfortable with? And any questions?
I mean, I think it's actually funny that you say they wouldn't change your regular day-to-day practice, but for us in the community, it has, because, you know, 20 years ago, more than that, when I was training, obviously it was fit, and you're going to be admitted for 2 weeks minimum. And gradually we started using the HMAs and for MDS, then HMA plus venetoclax, and suddenly it changed a lot. So for us, paradigm has changed something, because it suddenly gives us that we should not be offering these patients just either go to the tertiary care center or hospice. We actually should be more active in participating in these patients with the tertiary care center, but at least not letting those folks say, oh, I cannot go there for 2 weeks. My kids are, they have a life, doc, et cetera, et cetera. So we want to be more engaged in that discussion. And that's why I think that probably Neil hits it in the head that we are now in the community more active with these therapies.
Yeah, I mean, really everything, as you said, the perception, I think, of AML and the community-based oncology has changed dramatically, because before, like you said, it was either, you know, to send them to a tertiary center for 7+3 or hospice, and this brought the general oncologist really into the AML scene. And now with all these targeted therapies, that's all we've been talking about all weekend. You guys are on board as well, so let's talk about where that fits in. And, of course, FLT3 and IDH are the first two topics, and then we'll get into the more recent one, super exciting, menin inhibitors. But, Courtney, let's talk about FLT3 and IDH.
And I'll just say one last statement about, because I can't help myself.
I knew once we got her started on
this. is what we don't want is for, you know, patients to stay in the community and get AzaVen and not go to transplant. Because if these are younger patients who are curable, right, you can do intensive chemotherapy, you can do HMA-Ven, but HMA-Ven is not curative in and of itself. So just a plea to, you can do HMA-Ven if that's the most appropriate thing for your patient. They have adverse risk by ELN 2022, but do make sure that you refer them to a tertiary care center because they need a transplant.
Okay, so, and I had to add on as well. I think what's critically important is that you know the biology of the disease. And if you're sending off your samples to vendors and you're waiting 2 weeks, but you're going to decide to just give everyone HMA-Ven, that might not be the best thing for your patient. If they then turn out to have curable disease with intensive chemotherapy, like the patient I'm treating right now, who was 75 years old, but had an 821 translocation and had no response to decitabine venetoclax, and now is getting salvage therapy with a regimen from MD Anderson with gemtuzumab, azogamycin, and fludarabine, Ara-C, and G-CSF flag. And we'll see what the outcome will be. But what resonated with that patient was it's potentially curative.
Well, yeah, I mean, sorry for interrupting you, Neil, but one of the things that we are definitely telling our peers is wait for the NGS, wait for cytogenetics, don't treat. But again, based on my age, back in those days, we were like, oh, Friday afternoon special, acute leukemia induced. So it's we're changing all that.
Well, also, you guys, you know, throw out these, you know, kind of variations and genetics things and all that, and you think we understand what you're talking about, and we don't. So that's the other problem, is trying to really, I mean, I don't know, maybe AI would help in that regard too, because it's just, I mean, you saw the stuff we've been through the last 2 days, and now on top of that, I don't even know the thing you just talked about. I don't even know what it is.
H21, sorry. Very favorable to intensive
core
chemo.
Core binding factor.
Yeah. Oh, no, core binding factor, okay. I think there's another H20. One in there that I didn't get. But anyhow, all right, let's get back to FLT3 and IDH.
So FLT3 and IDH, talking about targeted therapies, here are my disclosures. And just to remind people that FLT3 is one of the most common mutations. So NPM1 and FLT3 are the two most common in AML. About a third of patients overall, they tend to be younger. These tend to be associated with more proliferative leukemias, often an elevated white count when they present, a more kind of dramatic presentation often. And there's two different flavors of FLT3. There's the ITD and the TKD. And the ITD in particular is a higher risk one. We have now two different standards for newly diagnosed FLT3 mutated patients. We have the midostaurin that you add to 7 and 3 on the left. This is from the RATIFY study. And then on the right, from Quantum First, we now have 7 and 3 with quizartinib, specifically for FLT3 ITD mutated patients. And you can kind of like, you know, at first blush, these look like very similar curves, but they are different populations. You'll notice on the right, quizartinib is specific to the ITD only, so you're only enrolling those patients, and it did have an extended eligibility in terms of age. So older patients who, in general, don't do as well with intensive chemo were enrolled. Which reminds me to kind of talk about the three main FLT3 inhibitors that we use in AML. There is midostaurin and gilteritinib, the top and the bottom, which are the type 1 inhibitors that are effective for both the ITD and the TKD. And then quizartinib is a type 2 inhibitor, so it's just a different structure, and it's only effective for the FLT3 ITD. So midostaurin and quizartinib are the two we have with intensive chemo for our newly diagnosed patients, and then gilteritinib in the relapse setting as a single agent is where it is approved. So we have these different inhibitors. We've got the type 1 and the type 2 that we mentioned. And then also there's the first generation and the second generation. So the difference between midostaurin and gilteritinib, as you get more selective, there's less of the other KIT. We were just talking about KIT. The other mutations. Okay, so Quantum First is highlighted here. A couple slides just to go into the details of this study. This is for patients 18 to 75 years of age, FLT3 ITD only. I've highlighted and noticed that this started in 2016, which was before midostaurin was approved. So this study was compared to placebo. So you get 7 and 3 with quizartinib or placebo, followed by HIDAC consolidation with quizartinib or placebo. And then there was a continuation, what we would call maintenance phase, with either quizartinib or placebo. The overall survival curve is shown here again. You'll notice the median overall survival is double with, the way that 50% falls. And what is also impressive is when you look at MRD, right, how deep of a remission your patient is in. Quizartinib is blue, placebo is green, and you will see that, there is variability here, but on average, especially at that 10 to the minus 4 cutoff, which is what the FDA wants to see, there were more patients on the quizartinib arm that had deep remission. And when you look all the way at the bottom, that not detectable at all, it was a doubling of that. About 10 to 20% of patients became FLT3 negative, not only in remission, but had lost that FLT3 by sensitive techniques. And then what I think is really important is in patients who did not go to transplant. And remember, most of these patients are frontline. They're young. They should be going to transplant. But for whatever reason, not everyone can. And in these patients that didn't go to transplant, you can see here the benefit of quizartinib versus placebo as a maintenance in improving overall survival, which I think is impactful, although there was not a double randomization of this study. So there's not a specific approval for this maintenance portion. Then I was asked to talk about quizartinib in the newly diagnosed setting for FLT3 wild-type patients. So this is a little bit like strange to wrap your mind around, because we had just said quizartinib is supposed to be only for FLT3 ITDs. But actually, there is some evidence that quizartinib may have activity outside of FLT3 ITD. And so this was a study that was run in Spain. It's called the KIWI study, and it looked at patients appropriate for intensive chemotherapy that were not FLT3 mutated to get quizartinib or placebo in combination with 7 and 3. And what was interesting is they actually did see benefit to adding quizartinib compared to placebo in these FLT3 wild-type patients. And then they looked further, and they looked at the different subgroups, and what, you know, those of you who are not leukemia experts, but these are like leukemia-sensitive mutations. NPM1, DNMT3A, FLT3, TKD, oftentimes these patients respond to standard intensive chemotherapy. So the thinking is maybe these are kind of chemo-sensitive patients and you're giving them kind of a stronger chemotherapy by the addition of quizartinib. But they have created a FLT3 gene expression profile, kind of similar to like the Oncotype DX, I guess, of who is more likely to respond to quizartinib, even if you do not have a FLT3 mutation. And that has led to a very, very large phase 3 study called the Quantum Wild Study, which, if it's not fully enrolled yet, it is almost about to be. Over 700 patients enrolled to intensive chemotherapy with quizartinib or placebo, and then there is a separate, the red arm C, second randomization to quizartinib versus placebo maintenance to look at that maintenance question.
So before you go on, just want to ask Harry, you know, because you made the analogy to Oncotype, and actually I don't know if you how much you talked to your colleague Shannon Weston, but it reminds me a lot of actually like the LOH score that they use in ovarian cancer. So these are people who don't have BRCA mutations, but they have this signature that somehow gets generated off. What do you think is going on in these patients, Harry?
Well, what you have to remember is FLT3 is actually expressed on all AML blasts. And in fact, there are bispecific T-cell engagers being directed at FLT3 wild type. And quizartinib has activity in the FLT3 native protein. And it's been shown that FLT3 overexpression, not the mutation, FLT3 overexpression is associated with worse outcomes in AML. It's been shown that chemotherapy causes upregulation of the FLT ligand, which then will cause dimerization of that FLT3 receptor and activation. And it's been shown in the phase 1 study that patients who were truly negative for the FLT3 ITD responded to quizartinib at a slightly higher dose. So what I think is happening here is that we do have this signature of gene expression that's where you're driven by FLT3, you're addicted to that FLT3, and in some of those patients where that's going on, we will see the benefit.
Let me just make another comment, getting back to the idea of the general medical oncologists and all. You know, we've been talking about, obviously, in CME, FLT3 for a long time, all the way back to the the initial, I think it was a sorafenib paper that was presented. And it was only recently that I realized, because, you know, we had the EGFR thing here, and you could see how effective targeted therapy is in lung cancer. And I just never actually realized how effective targeted therapy is in AML. Yeah. I mean, the hazard rates are really impressive. You always thought about AML as something you have to blast away with chemotherapy. But these hazard rates are impressive. You know, it's a big hit.
It is. Yeah. And you have to identify it at the beginning of treatment. And that's what I was saying before. You have to know that you had a FLT3 ITD mutation there, so you know on day 8 to add in your FLT3 inhibitor.
And if this pans out that it's going to be more than a FLT3, this sort of signature thing, how many more patients are going to be eligible? Like how
It would double it, right? So about 30% of patients are FLT3 mutated, but another like 30% or so have this signature that would, so it would really open up.
All right, gilteritinib. I was thinking gilteritinib was going to move into the first line. It doesn't seem to be happening, though.
No, there's actually been 2 randomized studies recently that was, the attempt was to move gilteritinib up to the front line, and unfortunately both of them were not designed the best in retrospect, but unfortunately are negative studies. So gilteritinib will remain in the salvage. But, you know, to your point of a targeted therapy being effective compared to intensive chemotherapy, you know, the options for the chemotherapy arm on this gilteritinib randomized study was FLAG-IDA, MEC, or lower intensity therapy. So, you know, you can blast a patient away, but they do twice as better by just giving them gilteritinib in the relapse setting. So an oral outpatient, and with an over 50% response rate, 25% transitioning to transplant. So this is definitely something to consider. You don't have to give chemotherapy when you have an effective target in the relapse setting with gilteritinib for sure. And this is just additional follow-up of the ADMIRAL trial, which was published and presented recently, highlighting the fact that in patients who go to transplant and then resume that gilteritinib as ongoing maintenance post-transplant, a third of them were still alive more than 2 years later without relapsing.
Keep going.
Okay. And then we will talk about IDH mutations, which are another, not the most, NPM1 and FLT3 are the most common, but IDH1 and IDH2 together are about 20% of AML patients. IDH2 is a little more common, about 12 to 15%. IDH1 is about 8 to 10%. These are, as opposed to FLT3, these are often older patients. For some reason that no one knows, these are the patients that will have a low white count, circulating blasts, but have a sustained platelet count at diagnosis. So if the platelets are 200 when you've got your new diagnosis, they're probably going to have an IDH mutation. There is two frontline therapies for the older IDH1 mutated patient. We talked about AzaVen already. The VIALE-A looked at the subset of IDH1 mutated patients, and that's in green on the left. There is also an approval of azacitidine with the IDH1 inhibitor ivosidenib. This is the AGILE trial. With composite remission rates over 50% and a median survival of about 2.5 years. So quite compelling. And if you know the IDH1 mutation status before you're starting a lower intensity combination, I would encourage AZA-IVO. The response rate and the overall survival is shown again here, highlighting some of the AEs. Just, we all know the AzaVen kind of story. It causes cytopenias. It can cause cytopenia-related infections. With AZA-IVO, you don't really see that as much. You have a nice count recovery. The difference here in terms of what to expect is you can have QT prolongation, and you can have differentiation syndrome. So this is one of the differentiating agents in leukemias that you have to be mindful of, kind of this cytokine type flu-like illness that can happen, and steroids can help a lot. There's a new kid on the block. So in addition to ivosidenib, which is the IDH1 inhibitor that has been approved now in the frontline and relapse setting, we also have olutasidenib, which is slightly different. It's smaller. It has CNS penetration. It binds more quickly and more quickly kind of has an off rate. So it's a twice-a-day drug as opposed to a once-a-day drug with ivosidenib. And it has less wild-type binding. So they have not been compared head-to-head. These are putting two different studies together in the relapse setting, looking at either IVO or Aluta for our relapsed patients with an IDH1 mutation. And what you'll notice, you know, is the remission rates, whether it's a composite remission or a complete remission or an overall response rate, are really quite similar. But what's different is the duration of those remissions, which really seem to favor olutasidenib. And so the question is, you know, is it the patient population that's different, or, you know, is olutasidenib a little bit of a better drug? We don't really know. When you look at the study populations, I've highlighted the things that are a little bit different. IVO patients are a little bit younger, but they are more likely to have higher risk cytogenetics, to have P53 mutations, to be multiply relapsed or refractory and have had prior transplant. So it does seem like it's a you know, higher risk population. So there is that to consider. Side effects with olutasidenib are pretty similar to ivosidenib, which are, in general, there's not very much. There is differentiation syndrome that you need to be aware of. With IVO, you have QTC, as I mentioned. With Aluta, you don't have QT prolongation issues, but you can have transaminitis. So there is on-target transaminitis that can happen, which is not as well highlighted in this slide, but can be seen, and so you do want to be monitoring for ALT and AST.
Any difference in differentiation syndrome?
No, same. About 12 to 15% overall, like grade 3 or higher, where you're hospitalizing them, they're unstable, is about 7%.
Harry, do you think these are usually being picked up and managed, or some people are not getting picked, diagnosed?
These will probably only be seen on your myeloid gene panel unless you're doing PCR specifically. So you have to wait to get that result back. And what you really need to remember is that IDH mutations could be later events in leukemogenesis, occur at relapse. So you have to check again at the time of relapse. The same is true for FLT3 mutations as well.
What was it in terms of differentiation syndrome? Do you think this is usually picked up? Or is, are there maybe situations where it's not even picked up?
No, I think these patients are getting sick. They're being admitted, and I'll make some comments to that.
Yeah, of course, later. With menin inhibitors, for
yeah.
sure.
Yeah, yeah, we'll talk about it. I think at the years ago, we were not really thinking about differentiation syndrome, and so patients were admitted, and you assumed it was relapse disease, or you assumed it was an infection, and you would miss the fact that it was DS, and you need to start steroids. We've become, I think, just more confident that it's okay to give steroids in leukemia patients, so you treat all those things at once. You only know if it's differentiation syndrome in retrospect if they respond to steroids. So you've got to, you know, treat a possible infection with broad spectrum antibiotics and give steroids. But if, you know, if there are effusions, if there's swelling, if there are low grade fevers and they're culture negative and no infection grows and they get better within 24 hours from steroids, it's probably DS.
And Harry, would you say like menin inhibitors, the actual mechanism of action with IDH inhibitors is differentiation?
Well, absolutely. Mm-hmm. That, I mean, that's one of them. I think that's the simplest for my poor brain to wrap my head around, you know, in terms of allowing differentiation. But we know that IDH mutations are involved in a number of other processes that can lead to leukemia. And I think the same is true for menin inhibitors. These menin inhibitors or the mutations in NPM1 and KMT2A, sure, they act through menin, but there are other pathways that they clearly must involve.
Interesting. Gus, you had a question?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I have to start looking for analogies, but, I mean, tumor lysis syndrome is one thing. Differentiation syndrome is another thing, but when you were mentioning the data with the combined therapy with the AZA and the IDH, I think it was in first line.
Yep.
Do we see a pattern where maybe by combining and therefore preventing the leukocytosis of the, when combined the medications, we see a lower differentiation syndrome, at least clinically?
That is true, yes. When you know, if you have only a differentiating agent that you're using, you're going to see more DS. If you're adding it to chemotherapy or something else, some sort of combination, you will have, in general, less likelihood of having
point.
DS. Yep, absolutely. And then just a comment about olutasidenib in the setting of post-venetoclax. So this is something now like HMA-Ven, you know, is being used for the front line for, you know, certainly all of our chemo-ineligible patients and maybe some of our chemo-eligible higher-risk adverse patients. And so we're now seeing a lot of patients that are post-venetoclax, and it's really challenging. You can look at all sorts of different outcomes by different institutions. Post-venetoclax outcomes are awful, like 3 to 4 months median survival. And so what's actually pretty impressive is the olutasidenib study started late enough that it was after the venetoclax approvals, and they enrolled a handful of patients that had failed venetoclax, and they actually did really well. This is some of the best post-ven data that exists in AML. So if you're going to, if you have a post-ven IDH1 mutated patient and you're thinking Ivo or Oluta, the data here is with Oluta, and I would encourage that. I will highlight just quickly the fact that we've talked about all the lower intensity therapies for our newly diagnosed IDH1 because they tend to be older. But there are some younger IDH1 mutated patients, and there's actually a very large European randomized study that is finished enrollment and that we may actually get some results in some of our European summer meetings of 7 and 3 with either enasidenib or ivosidenib or placebo, depending on if you're IDH1 or IDH2 mutated. And so we don't know the results yet, but there's some rumors that there may be some late-breaking abstracts to kind of go through this data. And there was an update by Eitan Stein at this past ASH meeting looking at the long-term of the original phase 1, 7, and 3 with ivosidenib, showing really impressive 3-year overall survivals and nice durable cures in many of these patients who got 7 and 3 with ivosidenib, went to transplant, and then ivo maintenance. So this may end up being something, you know, in the next year that could be another approval for Ivo in the intensive chemo-treated patients. I'll close just with a kind of a comparison. We didn't talk much about enasidenib. There hasn't been any new data of the IDH2 inhibitor enasidenib for relapsed IDH2 mutated patients. And then there's the Ivo and the Aluta are the two IDH1 mutated patients in the relapse setting. Along the top, you can see the outcomes. They really overlap each other. This is what you can expect with single agent targeted therapies for AML. And then the circles got a little off, but IDH differentiation syndrome happens kind of pretty much across the board with all of these agents. Hyperbilirubinemia, an indirect, like Gilbert's-like bilirubin, can happen with enasidenib. Ivo has the QT, and then olutasidenib has the transaminitis to be thinking about.
So just a follow-up back to Harry. In the intensive therapy ineligible patient, including patients who may be very elderly, maybe 90-plus, how do you approach IDH mutant, and how do you approach FLT3?
Yeah, I've adopted the idea of using Ivo-Aza in elderly patients who have an IDH1 mutation. And of course, you know, we're comparing between two large randomized trials. The AGILE trial, interestingly, closed or finished accrual just when venetoclax became available in Europe. So, you know, it's going to be skewed by that. And I really do believe that there's something to our ability to sequence these therapies now to extend the survival of older patients. But why then would I choose ivosidenib over venetoclax besides some real-world data suggesting a benefit? One is during, and Courtney showed this initially in the phase 1b study, in the first cycle, you do get increase in the neutrophil count, which could be very important in your patients who are admitted with infection or at risk of infection. And the second is that you actually, once you get them in remission, ivosidenib is not myelosuppressive. And so they just continue on the same dose, whereas venetoclax, we're always playing with and deciding what to do with the dose of venetoclax, and there are all these drug-drug interactions. So it's a little bit easier for our patients. And I've even gotten into the habit now of these older patients at some point dropping the azacitidine. There's no data to support what I just said. And then continuing with ivosidenib because they said they've had enough of coming to see me every month.
Older patient with FLT3?
Older patient with FLT3, very debatable. The MyeloMatch study is looking at AzaVen versus AzaVen with two different sequences of gilteritinib. We really don't have the answer. The data of the triplet looks very good from the MD Anderson data, from the Viceroy data. But those are, you know, selected populations being treated at large academic centers, and we really have to see, do we need a triplet? Or, again, I'm a believer in sequencing, and that's what my older patients like to hear from me. If A doesn't work, I've got B and C and D waiting for them.
Courtney, anything you want to add to that? Any situations where you would use a 95-year-old just targeted therapy?
If they have an IDH mutation, yes, I think that gives you, or FLT3, I suppose. But in general, the older patients are going to be the IDH mutated patients. And if they are old and frail, then a single agent IDH inhibitor makes good sense. But azacitidine with an IDH inhibitor, you know, actually is pretty well tolerated, right, which is why we're kind of struggling with that. That situation doesn't happen that often where you don't feel like you can add a hypomethylating agent.
New favorite topic,
yeah.
Menin inhibitors. Love it.
Yes, a new class of agents, the menin inhibitors. So I have too many slides as usual, but I'm going to focus on the first half, which is really the current state of the art. Here are my disclosures. So first, what are these diseases? Menin inhibition is being used predominantly in two disease states, NPM1 mutated AML and acute leukemias with KMT2A, also known as MLL gene rearrangements. NPM1 is a very common mutation in AML. 30% of AMLs at diagnosis will have it. The susceptible or pathogenic mutation is a frameshift mutation, the last coding exon, that causes the NPM1 nucleophosmin protein to be shuttled outside of the nucleus where it's normally supposed to be into the cytoplasm. I'll come back to that. It is a driver mutation in AML. In fact, the WHO says it doesn't matter what the blast percentage is anymore. If you see an NPM1 mutation in a marrow that you've done for some cytopenia, for example, that's AML. And so it genetically defines and drives AML. It's frequently associated, however, with other mutations, which, by the way, we can now target. And you can identify this in your patients because it has a very distinct immunophenotype with myeloid antigens, 13, 33, MPO, but lacking stem cell antigens like CD34 and HLA-DR. And you can see the very characteristic fish mouth nuclei. So NPM1 mutated AML is considered favorable risk. Now, in AML, favorable risk isn't so favorable. This is recent. This is retrospective data of patients treated in the German and Swiss registries with 7 and 3, basically, followed by high-dose Ara-C and transplant. And I just want you to look at the gray line over on the right-hand side of the slide. That's NPM1 mutated AML, favorable risk, with a survival of somewhere between 40 and 50%. Not so favorable. However, things may be changing even before we have the menin inhibitors to use in this population of patients. And so venetoclax, we know, is very active here. On the left, in the green line, you're looking at patients who get HMA venetoclax or azacitidine venetoclax who have an NPM1 mutation without FLT3, RAS, or P53 mutation. You can see a median survival there of 39 months, 3 years median survival. And Courtney's work at MD Anderson looking at the addition of venetoclax to intensive chemotherapy regimens showing an 83% 3 year survival in the NPM1 mutated patients with a diploid karyotype. And she showed you the quizartinib data with 7 and 3. That population was mostly NPM1. So the playing field is changing. And it's also true that gemtuzumab, azogamycin, and intensive chemotherapies may be very important in this population of patients. This is data from the AML 17 and 19 studies done in the United Kingdom, where they showed that using FLAG-IDA with or without gemtuzumab, azogamycin led to higher rates of MRD negative remissions, lower incidence of cumulative incidence of relapse in the bottom right, and better overall survival, again, around 80%. So remember that when I come to the current studies that are ongoing in the world, looking at the benefit of adding menin inhibitors. However, once a patient relapses, their outcome isn't so good. Now, where I forgot to draw the oval is up in the top left where you're looking at all therapies and the response rates across all lines of therapy. This is retrospective data from MD Anderson showing a 26%, 24% CR rate. It's 24%, not very good. But if you look at that population of patients who probably got intensive chemotherapy and then got HMA with venetoclax all the way over on the right, you could see in all lines of therapy or in just the second line, a 70 to 76% response rate, okay, in the relapse setting. Now, KMT2A is a little bit different of a story. KMT2A is also a driver mutation. It is fused to multiple hundreds of different fusion genes, fusion proteins, or genes that make the fusion protein, and is found in both pediatric acute leukemias and in adult acute leukemias, both AML, ALL, and mixed phenotype acute leukemia. This is data presented at ASH of looking at retrospective data of 325 patients with KMT2A rearranged AML who were previously untreated. One important point here made also by the publication by Gus Issa from MD Anderson is these patients with KMT2A rearranged AML often do not have other driver mutations. You could see some of them there, but it's actually the minority. This is truly the driver mutation. But what they saw in this retrospective chart review is that the CR rates with intensive chemotherapy were pretty high, 75% compared to HMA venetoclax, 37%, and that translated into difference in overall in disease-free survival. However, when these patients relapse, their outcomes are dismal. Again, data from MD Anderson showing 10% response rates in the relapse setting with very poor median survival of 2 months, a 1 year survival of 7%, and a very high rate of cumulative incidence of relapse. So that's the background. So now we have menin inhibitors and NPM1 mutated and KMT2A rearranged AMLs are the largest population of patients where we believe menin inhibition is going to be helpful. So what you're looking at on the left-hand side of, well, it's on, in the top, I should say, is that when you have the menin binding to the normal KMT2A or the KMT2A rearranged protein, or when you have a nucleophosmin mutation, that is turning on expression of genes, HOXA9, HOX genes, MEIS1, that leads to a block in apoptosis, increased proliferation, and block in differentiation. The inhibitors uncouple that interaction between KMT2A and menin, allowing then downregulation of those genes and differentiation to occur. And what we've been able to show in all of the phase one data I'm about to show you is that the therapeutic doses of all of the menin inhibitors pretty much routinely lead to downregulation, decreased expression of HOXA9 and MEIS1. So we think we're hitting the target. So here you're seeing two of the FDA-approved drugs and two that are soon in close and follow-up. I'm going to talk more about revumenib and ziftomenib in the next slide, and then Blexi and enzomenib. This is a slide that one of the sponsors, the enzomenib people, love to show in their ASH presentations. They want to make the point that their drug is different. It was built differently. It was built so that it had all of the characteristics that a good drug that's active in AML should have. All these things that I have no idea what they are, and I really shouldn't be showing you this slide because I couldn't even explain it to you. But it does make the point that these are different chemically. Okay, they're not all the same. And so before I show you the rest of the data quickly, this is the take-home slide for you. Okay, revumenib and ziftomenib. They are both approved now. Revumenib is approved based on an expansion of the phase 1 data at the recommended phase 2 dose in the KMT2A rearranged and NPM1 mutated subsets. Ziftomenib, only NPM1. We studied it in KMT2A rearranged, but in 39 of the first of the patients who went in the phase 1 study, 4 died of differentiation syndrome. So the sponsor decided to only develop ziftomenib in combination for patients with KMT2A rearranged disease. Mm-hmm. These drugs are now FDA approved, but look at the response rates. They're 20 to 25%. Look at the duration of those responses, less than a half a year. They are associated with differentiation syndrome, which I'll make a comment on. They both can cause QT prolongation. You have to adjust the dose of one, revumenib, for CYP3A4 inhibitors. You don't have to do that with ziftomenib. And there's no details there about things that you would want to know. What's the response rate in people who have been previously exposed to venetoclax? Well, in our paper for ziftomenib, it seems to be about the same, ven-naive or ven-previously exposed. But in Martha Adriano's paper in Blood, with revumenib, the response rate in the patients previously exposed to ven might be a little bit lower. On the other hand, IDH-mutated patients respond very well to menin inhibitors without adding an IDH inhibitor. On the other hand, the FLT3-mutated, they respond, but the response rates are a little bit lower. Enzomenib, big points here. It can cause differentiation syndrome. It really has not been associated with QT prolongation. I forgot to tell you another difference between Revu and Zifto. One's twice a day, one's once a day. The once a day is the Zifto. Here's the response rates with KMT2A rearranged AML. You can see 40% CR/CRh rates. We're still looking at the trying to find the right recommended phase 2 dose of enzomenib, but you can see very high response rates there as well in the 40 to 50% range. Blexamenib, the thing to know about this drug is it can cause differentiation syndrome as well. And in the early part of the phase 1 study, there were deaths due to differentiation syndrome. And so what you can't tell in any of these slides is that, and this comes from an ASH presentation, is that there's a dose ramp-up of blexamenib. For the first 2 weeks, they get half the dose, and then they get full dose to try to offset this signal for differentiation syndrome. The doses that they're going to be going forward with are 100 milligrams twice daily. They've combined their data from the phase one study of the 90 milligram twice daily and 100 milligram twice daily. An important signal here that I'll come back to at the very end, neutropenia was more likely at the higher doses. Here you can see the risk of differentiation syndrome, and I already mentioned that there were two fatal cases and what they do to mitigate the differentiation syndrome. What you're seeing there in that bottom right box is what all of the slides will say about how we mitigate differentiation syndrome. We interrupt the dosing of Blexi, of Zifto. We give corticosteroids, hydroxyurea for the leukocytosis. We give supportive care, and then we resume the menin inhibitor at the full dose when the symptoms have returned to normal. What wasn't in the ASH presentation is what I said at the beginning. There's a two-week dose ramp-up first to avoid differentiation syndrome. And in terms of the response rate at the recommended phase 2 doses, there in the middle, you can see the CR/CRh rate right in the center of that blue rectangle is 33%. But again, the median duration of those responses, 6 months. And that was seen no matter what drug you're looking at, and duration response and overall survival in KMT2A or NPM1, low response rates, short duration, which kind of makes me wonder. I've been thinking of NPM1 and KMT2A rearranged arrangements as the drivers of AML. And I'm like, finally, we're going to have a drug that's like arsenic and ATRA in APL, where those genetic changes are driving the disease. But they're not. And so what do we need to know? We need to know why these responses are so low. We seem to be hitting the target in terms of HOXA9 and MEIS1, but is that the only benefit of or the only way that these mutations cause acute leukemia? We know that mutations can occur and other things can get in the way of these responses. And of course, these things are being combined, and what you don't see in this data of relapse refractory acute leukemias is how many of these patients and what had prior exposure to venetoclax and what were the responses in the venetoclax failures. And in fact, for the ziftomenib, we're about to publish that in the ziftomenib-treated patients, the responses you're seeing there were higher in the venetoclax-naive patients, but much lower in the patients who relapsed after venetoclax. In fact, I would say the response didn't look any different than single-agent menin inhibitor in that case. Maybe they lasted longer, though. And we're combining this with intensive chemotherapy. Just as was pointed out earlier, there's a lower rate of differentiation syndrome that we're seeing when we combine with chemotherapy. And we didn't see any significant signal for prolongation of cytopenias. And the response rates up at the top, you can see the CR rates of 74% for KMT2A rearranged, 84% for NPM1 mutated. Those look the same as just 7 and 3, by the way. So how are we going to tell if any of this is better? And the same goes for true for the NPM1 and KMT2A rearranged that are newly diagnosed getting these combinations of azaven with menin inhibitors. How are we going to tell if these are better than what we could expect with just the azaven or 7 and 3? And of course, you need large randomized clinical trials. When we think about a trial like this, our colleagues in the United Kingdom would say, this is very interesting, but you got the wrong control arm. So would our MD Anderson people. We want venetoclax in there. Mm-hmm. So let me finish by saying menin inhibitor monotherapy is active in this disease, but the CR/CRh rates are really low. The duration of response is short. We don't know which subset of patients will respond the best or for the longest. And even though that these genes are drivers of leukemogenesis through menin KMT2A directed expression of HOX genes and MEIS1, we know that there are other leukemic drivers. We know that there are menin in mutations that are blocking some of this response. Finally, enzomenib of the four is the only one that has not been, Blexi and enzo really have low rates of QT prolongation. Sorry for the typo in the slide. Revu and Zifto have higher rates. Differentiation syndrome occurs with all of them, but the point I want to make here is the one that was mentioned earlier. You have a patient comes in with a rising white count and fevers and pulmonary infiltrates and hypoxia, and what are you thinking? That might be relapse of disease and pneumonia or capillary leak syndrome in the lungs, or it could be differentiation syndrome. The only way we can distinguish these is by treating infection, treating the leukocytosis with hydroxyurea, and using dexamethasone for differentiation syndrome. And if you come in the next day and the patient has not been sent to the ICU, you know you're probably treating differentiation syndrome effectively. And what we don't talk about is that we do have actually preclinical data that all of the menin inhibitors should be expected to cause some degree of myelosuppression. And I think the proof of that in these studies is the fact that the CR-CRh rates are always lower than the morphologic leukemia-free state and the CRi rates where counts aren't recovering. So we're going to have to deal with that. And on top of all of those questions, now we're moving these to frontline in combination with 7 and 3, in combination with HMA-VEN. So my plea here is this is not so simple to just get a drug off the shelf and give it to your patient with AML. There are a lot of questions we have, now hopefully we'll be able to figure some more stuff out. But it's an exciting time in AML.
So that's for sure. So one final question and then a revelation I just had. A question from the audience. Courtney, ? Oluda after Aza-Ivo.
Yeah, if you're starting with Aza-Ivo, or for that matter, Aza-Oluda, I would prioritize venetoclax, a venetoclax combination. I think it's more likely that you're going to have a response to a ven regimen than to use one IDH inhibitor and then the other. I don't know that Oluda is that much more selective, but certainly it can be tried. And there is some data, maybe like a 10 to 15% response rate with one versus the other when you swap.
And again, looking at the myeloid gene panel then would be important because, as Courtney could tell you, these patients could develop an IDH2 mutation or another mutation that will allow you to give a targeted therapy.
So revelation is one of the kind of jokes we've had this weekend is when we start out Friday night is I put into ChatGPT, what's the most important paper of the year? And then for every module, you know, we were looking to see. And every time I sat down, we did 17 modules now since Friday night. And every time I've sat down here to do that, someone in Zoom put in, I'm not sure what AI tool they use, but they were telling me what the top three papers were of the year for each thing. Uh-huh. And in fact, here, the paradigm study, this AI thing pulled out the paradigm study. But the thing I realized is the fact there's somebody out there who's watched the entire thing this weekend. And the idea that, it's not just about what's here. The content that we developed not only is being viewed a lot, potentially could be viewed. I mean, here's somebody maybe sat the entire weekend, I don't know, on the beach or wherever. And then from now on, we'll be distributing this content and all the whatever, YouTube and every other mechanism. So pretty interesting world nowadays. And it's been such an honor and pleasure to be here this weekend and to work with you all. Hopefully we'll be able to do this again next year. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for coming. Have a great day.
Thank you.